Now you have to be nice.
Good afternoon, everyone. I call this Committee on Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. With that, we'll begin with the approval for minutes of March 14, 2023. Vice Chair Bannon, do you want to move the approval for minutes?
Yes, I would love to move the minutes, Mr. Chair, from
March 14th,
2023.
Vice Chair Bannon moves the approval for minutes for March 14th, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none, the minutes for March 14th, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we have a couple of bills before us this afternoon. We'll start with House File 1384. Representative Hicks, welcome to your committee, and please move the House File 1384 and proceed with your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee. I move House File 1384 be laid over for possible inclusion. Mr. Chair and committee members, today I'm here to present House File 1384, which ends the unacceptable practice of taxing disability. Medicaid for Employed Persons with Disabilities, or how we refer to it, MAEPD, is a critical Medicaid program in our state. It was established over 20 years ago to fill a gap in our Medicaid system to allow people who have disabilities and need long-term care supports to receive the needed Medicaid services while also working and generating income, just like workers who don't have disabilities. Representative Quam, this is the coalition of the cliff that you and I have talked about for years and years, and removes that cliff permanently moving forward. While this program was created to make it easier for people with disabilities to work, the asset limit, premiums, and administrative burdens are significant barriers for employment and keep people with disabilities living in poverty. Many accessing the program face financial distress as they are under constant threat of losing their safety net supports that they need to stay alive. House File 1384 was created directly by people accessing MAPD. Each change in the proposal would directly impact them, their families, and others who access the program. House File 1384 makes the following changes. It removes the asset limit and premium so that people with disabilities can do more than just survive, but also thrive. It encourages work by removing barriers to increasing employment or taking a raise. It expands eligibility for Medicare savings programs to all recipients who are dual eligible for MA and Medicare and required to enroll in Medicare. It ensures that those who have been disenrolled due to high premiums can re-enroll without penalty. Today, you're going to hear from people who know this better than me, the advocates, who have worked directly on this bill to create it. But before that, something very important I want you all to understand, and something I think we sometimes forget when we talk about people with disabilities, is that the individuals accessing MAPD are paying taxes. Many are paying for other insurance, like Medicare or private insurance through an employer, in addition to MAPD premiums. For those who need long-term supports and services to both remain alive and also remain working, they can only access these things through medical assistance. They have one avenue to do that, and we charge them to access it. That is why this is an unnecessary additional tax on disability. This bill will also provide cost savings for the state, relieving DHS and lead agencies of the administrative processes and burdens of calculating and collecting premiums. I will now turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rob Woodlick. I'm a MAPD recipient. I work at the University of Minnesota, and I have my own business and do a whole bunch of other stuff. You know, this bill today is really about opportunity and equality for people with disabilities. I'm a quadriplegic, and I depend on these benefits to survive, to get out of bed, to come here today. My caregiver is right over there. And you know, I wouldn't be able to be here today if it wasn't for the disability services that I received from the state through this program. and I wouldn't be able to work either. And, you know, I'm really proud, and I want to contribute to the community. I want to work. I want to make a better future for myself and others. And, you know, and I think, you know, that's important for people with disabilities, and I do a good job at what I do. You know, but no matter what, I'm still going to be disabled. I'm going to still rely on these disabilities, on the benefits, and, you know, unless I win the lottery, I really won't be able to get off this program. And, you know, and this program is really great. It's impacted my life and a lot of other lives. There's some hurdles, you know, such as asset limits, the premiums for people who are just starting out to work, and a lot of other kind of hiccups that we're trying to fix here since its inception in 2009. So, you know, I have friends that have had to leave their jobs, have had to turn down employee stock options when all their coworkers have gotten them, turned down raises, can't afford a home, can't afford food at times, because they have to choose between food and maintaining their benefits, get out of bed. And so it's just, we're working to try to fix that. I'm also a small business owner, and, you know, if my business does well at a certain point, I'd have to, like, make it either fail or give it away. And, you know, I have employees. This is a whole, you know, asset limit is kind of, it's a short roof for somebody like me. So, yeah. You know, I think it's important to note, no matter what, I'll be on disability benefits. I'll just be working or I won't be working. And I pay taxes. I'm paying the state back. You know, I'd rather be out working and helping myself, helping others, and versus not working. And, yeah, so, you know, when you look at the fiscal note, it's, the doctor said I'm disabled. Like, you can see I'm still in a wheelchair. Like, that's, you know, like, it's, I'll just be in one bucket or another of what benefits program it is. So, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Woodley. The next person on the list is Ms. Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and committee members. I am Jillian Nelson, the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. Many of you know I am an autistic adult, and I am a recipient of medical assistance for employed people with disabilities. This program changed my life, and I am here today asking for you to support House File 1384. Paul Wellstone once said, "It is the belief that extremes and excess of inequality must be reduced so that each person is free to fully develop to his or her full potential." The current structure of MAEPD is built on a foundation of excess and extreme inequality, essentially charging a high tax and heavy administrative burden for the unchosen reality of being disabled. A study by the National Disability Institute in 2020 showed that people with disabilities pay over $17,000 a year more than a person without a disability just to exist. In our community, we call this the disability tax. This is all the things we pay extra for to live an accessible life. Like, I need a mattress that reduces chronic pain. I need sensory tools. Sometimes I need to park closer and pay more for parking. And countless other things I pay more for to make the world as accessible as possible. For me, one of the biggest contributors to my disability tax is my MAEPD premiums. Every month I make choices. Pay my premiums or pay my car payment on time. Pay my premiums or buy produce and non-processed protein. Pay my premiums or pay my electric bill in full. I shouldn't have to make these choices. No one should have to make these choices. For me, though, the choice is quite simple. I pay my premiums because without them, I don't have the supports I need to survive. MAEPD premiums were put in place at the conception of this program as a vehicle to give disabled people pride so that we could feel pride in contributing. I rarely feel pride being forced to choose my premiums over everything else. I would be proud to be financially stable. I would be proud to have a savings account with more than two digits. I would be proud to someday be able to afford to buy a house. And this is why we need to eliminate the premiums for MAEPD. This change is not going to create a mass accumulation of wealth, but it will offer us some relief and reduce the cost of being disabled. It will be the start of lifting ourselves out of the forced poverty of the disability world. MAEPD participants are currently paying 7.5% of our income at only 150% of the federal poverty guidelines. With a cost of living on the increase and the reality that most people with disabilities are underemployed and underpaid, 7.5% makes a huge difference in quality of life and being stable. I do not need to pay my monthly premiums to contribute. By working, I am contributing to my care by being a taxpayer. And also because Medicaid requires that I carry primary insurance through my employer. That insurance is a greater contributor to my care needs than my premium will ever be. My private employer-based insurance pays an average of $80,000 a year before MA is responsible for anything. So MAEPD only provides what my primary does not. Occupational therapy, sensory therapy, my PCAs. And that is how I contribute to my care as an employed person with a disability. The elimination of the MAEPD premiums will mean a better life for me and for everyone else on this program. And as we learn from Paul Wellstone, we all do better when we all do better. Thank you for your support today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Nelson. So the next question is Jason. Please come to the testify table and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. I am Jason Bloomquist. I'm also an MAEPD recipient, as I have been on the program since its inception. And to echo a lot of what Jillian said, and I feel the same way. The elimination of MAEPD premiums and a Medicare premium would put more money in the hands of people with disabilities to pay their monthly expenses, and the asset limit is very prohibitive. I am a homeowner, and it's difficult in my case to save money for things like a new furnace, a new air conditioner, as my home is 22 years old now. So that's another aspect for a different day. As it stands right now, MA will take the value of my home as soon as I am not able to live there or I am deceased. But as I said, that's another bill for another day. But to take away the asset limit would allow me to live a life that's more like my coworkers, my community members that are able-bodied and don't have to deal with these limits. I do pay employer-based insurance right now, and I'm also being charged for my MA almost $300 a month. That $300 in my pocket, along with the Medicare premium, that would put over $400 in my pocket towards continuing to be a successful homeowner. And the asset limit just doesn't make sense in terms of if it does stay the way it is and MA is going to get my home, someday, then wouldn't they want their windfall to be bigger than smaller? So it's nonsensical. And the fact that they would do something like this to a viable group of people that has proven through this program that they can work and pay taxes, shouldn't these programs be viewed as an investment in viable people that can work rather than something that should be paid back at the end of your life by pushing all your chips to the middle of the table and giving them to someone else rather than a family member or friend that has helped you during your life, or leaving it to the organization of your choice and being able to leave a legacy as any American would want to do. A lot of the rest of what I had to say today was already echoed by Rob and Jillian, so I won't repeat it other than to say that as we exit COVID-19, these measures and dropping the EPD premium would also save the state much time and money, as right now they're only servicing accounts that are receiving cash assistance, and it would be more feasible to have the renewal yearly instead of every 6 months. With that, I will entertain any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Bloomquist. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? One more person? You have 2 minutes to testify. Please come to the testify table and introduce yourself for the record. Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Tobiso Rowan, and I access the MAEPD program. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1384, which would eliminate the asset limit and premiums. Right now, I can't save more than $20,000 in assets, even though I work full-time and pay taxes just like everyone else. I can't save enough money to buy a house or save up for retirement or save money for my son's college education. If I make too much in savings, my employment and health care will be compromised. I'm asking to eliminate assets because I want to save money for my future and my son's future, just like anyone else. When my income goes up, then my premiums go up. So I'm cautious about making more money or advancing in my career, because at some point I can't afford my premiums. I have a suprapubic catheter, a colostomy bag, and other medical needs that most people my age don't have. I need medical supplies just to go to the bathroom, which my MAEPD helps to subsidize. I have to pay Medicare premiums just to qualify for MAEPD. I once received SSI, Social Security income, after I had a spinal cord injury in 2011. I got SSI when I was recovering, but I went back to school, I graduated, and I found work. But I still have to pay Medicare premiums, even though I stopped receiving SSI. I pay Medicare premiums on top of my MAEPD premiums, private health insurance, and payroll taxes. Expansion of the Medicare savings program would help ensure I am not spending so much on my health care coverage every month. I've had pressure sores since the first year after my spinal cord injury. I've had surgeries and had to stay in the hospital for weeks at a time. If I can't work, I lose my MAEPD, and so I need to be able to re-enroll if that happens. I appreciate having health care coverage. It has been difficult to maintain my health care coverage. Let me give you an example of just how burdensome it is to in the current program to maintain employment and services. At one point, I had an overdue premium because I couldn't afford the premium. My Medicare was cut, and when I reapplied, the Medicare office lost my application, which my parents had hand-delivered to the Social Security office. Because I lost my Medicare, I ended up losing my MAEPD. I had to have my Senator Amy Klobuchar's office contact the St. Paul Social Security office after not getting responses for 6 months. Once I contacted Senator Klobuchar's office, my Medicare was reinstated shortly after. But why did I have to contact a U.S. Senator to resolve the issue that was not even my fault? I had to pay out of pocket for my medical supplies just to use the bathroom, which really hurt me financially and made my life a living hell. When it all comes down to it, is that what it all comes down to is that some of us have additional needs in life, including children, senior citizens, and people with disabilities. Why should I be subject to barriers because of the circumstances that the universe and God gave me? In my eyes, as a person with a disability, and as a person who has worked professionally with people with disabilities for over a decade, it is criminal to see the injustices that our laws allow towards people with disabilities. That is one reason why I support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony and sharing your story with us. Thank you so much for coming to this. Who else wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we have member discussions. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from the last testifier, it'd be nice to find out how we can take care of the incompetence that allows lost forms, months-long delays. That's unacceptable, and there needs to be some sort of a systematic way of fixing that, a ombudsperson or some route where we can have some quick and effective correction, because let's get rid of the stupid so that we can give the services. But my question to the author is, what federal interactions and waivers are involved or may be required for the implementation of this? Because almost every time we try something in the state, there are issues for compatibility with the feds.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Oh, sorry, Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam, for the question. It's a great question. So we will need federal approval for this. However, other states do not charge a premium. So CMS has approved that in other states. So I do not anticipate a concern there, given that it is a thing that's happening in other places.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that, but the tricky thing might be the asset limit. And I know we had discussed any technology required to assist you to be able to work and mainstream, or however you want to define it, should not be counted as an asset, because it really is more of a medical or an A type thing. But the getting rid of an asset limit, have there been any states that have done that? And wouldn't that require some sort of a waiver?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, Arizona did it. as well, and so, and another state, but I don't recall which one.
Washington,
thank you. Washington did it as well. It does not require a waiver. It would simply require an amendment to our state plan. So it just requires an SPA amendment. But it has been approved in other states, so we do not anticipate a barrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I really like the part that we're finally getting rid of the assets stuff. I think that, you know, years past, I can see why we had it. We had more employees that were looking for jobs, and if we had jobs that were getting filled by people that had a lot of stuff and we were helping them in different ways, I think that it was a kind of a balancer. Today, it's a much different world. I really like that part of this bill. I think when you first introduced the bill, it was a little different to the premiums, I think, were not waived at first. So the part that I'm just not, you know, I want to support this bill. I think that it's got a lot of things to it. But what I've heard from some of your testifiers, which did a great job, they want to be a part of the real world here. They want to be in this thing. Even if we had limits or caps on their premiums, I didn't know that maybe eliminating them completely was the answer, because I know even if it was, again, a limit to them or something, but having them a part of that still helps us manage the checkbook better at the state of Minnesota, too. I want to make sure that we don't take our eye off that ball. We are doing a lot of things in different committees with job, with workforce, nonprofits, and helping people get to work in the trainings. I'm looking also for the areas of where we cannot give up more than we absolutely need to. But the asset part of this is really powerful. So, again, I like the bill. I just want to ask about the change of it from initially to maybe where it is today. So I just, if I could get that, Mr. Chair, that'd be great.
Great question, Representative Becker. Just to reiterate, the asset limit is $20,000. It excludes the house you live in. It excludes assets from your spouse. It also excludes a vehicle, retirement account, and I will refer to the expert here.
Right.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. That was the amendment that we put forth in policy. And the reason for that, and the reason that I will continue to advocate for getting rid of the premium, is because, like you heard our testifier say, they're already paying premiums to Medicare and to their private insurance. They're already paying for their health care just like you and I do, right? The other piece that I will look to Ann to see if she's here, but the other piece is that we're not helping the state's checkbook with this program. The premiums we are collecting, the costs, the administrative costs to both calculate the premium, collect all the data to calculate the premium, and then the collection of the premium, the postage to mail out the stuff, the emails going out, the staff checking, the all of those pieces, we are not making money for the general register in this program. So what we are doing is saying to people with disabilities, we want you to prove your worth, your services. We want you to prove that you're working hard enough to stay on the planet. We want you to prove you're working hard enough to deserve these services. We want you to have skin in the game. They have skin in the game. Their skin is literally their skin. It is their livelihood. It is their ability to get their pressure sores treated. It is their ability to get out of bed in the morning. It is their ability to continue to work and pay taxes. They have skin in this game. Us putting our own perceptions of how they could be more engaged on them isn't helping the state's bottom line, and it isn't helping them. And so I don't believe in doing things just for the sake of doing them, and I think this is an opportunity, very much like the TEFRA fees that we talked about, to do the right thing for folks and encourage, instead of discourage, encourage increased participation, encourage them to take a raise, encourage them to move up the ladder, encourage them to start their own business, and encourage work instead of de-incentivize work by premiums.
With that, we have got 1 minute left for this bill. And so quickly, I don't know if Zelesnikar wanted to ask a comment. Representative Gilman, quick comment, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I just was curious, how many individuals are on MA?
EPD.
It's around 12,000.
I think it's around 12,000. Thank you, Chair. I think it's around 12,000, but I'll look to Ann for a head nod. She says yes.
Thank you. With that, did you want to renew your motion so we can go to the next bill?
Yes, I renew my motion for House File 1384.
Representative Hicks renews her motion, House File 1384, to be laid over. For possible inclusion, the bill is laid over. With that, we move to the House File 1436, Chair Bang. Welcome to the committee, Chair Vang. We have 15 minutes for this bill. I'll move that House File 1436 to be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of you may know that addressing some of the shortages in the mental health workforce has been a priority of mine for a number of years. It's not news that we're experiencing a severe shortage in the mental health workforce. With increased needs, we need to make sure that our workforce is able to serve our population. Mental health providers are significantly underpaid compared to other providers with the same level of education, preparation, expertise, and licensure. Between 2007 and 2014, only 49% of those completing their graduate education to become a mental health professional actually obtained their license. We also know that 88% of clinicians are white. The past 2 years, I've carried bills to address both the number of people in our mental health workforce and its diversity. This year, I have introduced House File 1436 to build on this work by continuing funding for three programs and to ensure that under the MERC program, providing care in the community is allowed, creating a pediatric primary care mental health training program, creating a Grow Your Own program to support people in obtaining a master's degree, creating a training program for people working with youth with a mental illness, and funding an additional psychiatric residency slot. In addition, we want to create a mental health and substance use disorder education center, focus on increasing the number of professionals, practitioners, and peers working in the mental health and substance use disorder treatment. We cannot meet the needs of our community without paying attention to our workforce, and we hope to make it happen this session. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll yield my time to my testifiers.
Sue Abdelhalden, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network, which is supporting and helped develop this bill. I'll just mention just a couple of things in the bill that I think are important. One is that we want to make sure that we have enough culturally specific providers and supervisors in the community. And we did get this passed, and what we have found from the program, this passed in 2021, we saw 215 mental health professionals from diverse communities become supervisors, which means they would actually be able to supervise about 400 students. So this program actually turned out to be very successful, which we're very excited about. The other thing is to create this Mental Health and Substance Use Disorder Education Center within the Health Department. We actually looked around the country, and Nebraska does this, and they've done it for several years. And what we found is that because someone is paying attention, right, looking at how many students are in the graduate school programs, what the diversity is, how many are becoming licensed, where we have shortages across the state, they have actually increased their mental health workforce by over 30%. So we think having kind of a focused attention on this will really help in our state. The other part that I think is important is also making sure that we can actually fund supervision. A lot of the professionals that we talked to, or graduates, I should say, said they had a hard time finding someone to provide the supervision, and they actually had to pay for it, which was a huge barrier because you can't include that in your student loans. And so by focusing on our providers who actually serve a lot of Medicaid clients who have a hard time attracting people because their payment rates are lower, having them provide the supervision actually attracts people to work for them and make sure that we get people across the finish line with supervision. I'll stop there, but I just wanted to point out those things, and I just really want to thank Representative Vang for her leadership all these years in making sure that we have a more robust mental health workforce.
Thank you. The next testifier is Dr. Schneid. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and the committee for this opportunity to speak. I'm Abigail Schneid. I am the pediatric chief resident at the University of Minnesota. I'm a board-certified pediatrician and in my final year of training. I'm a resident selected to supervise the education of the pediatric residency. Over 70% of practicing pediatricians in the state of Minnesota receive their training here at the University of Minnesota. Right now, there's a pilot program at the University of Minnesota in the primary care pediatric setting where mental health professionals serve as teachers for residents and other primary care providers in real time. Section 6 will provide ongoing funding for this important work. I will never forget a young male who was so anxious he couldn't start his college applications. The inability to start an application hurt his self-esteem and made him angry to the point that he was punching walls at home and getting in fights with family members. He came to me in primary care for a routine checkup and brought up his concerns. We identified that the patient had general anxiety disorder and decided to start medications. I needed help finding out how to safely and effectively help this patient in crisis. Having a psychiatrist as a resource helped me feel confident starting a medication, increasing a medication dose, or changing medications for him, rather than referring him to a psychiatrist where he would have spent many months waiting to see a provider. Waiting many months for care would have been a detriment to him and his family financially and emotionally, and he likely would have missed submitting his college applications. Instead, his anxiety became under control. He completed his applications, and he is now succeeding in college. I have used the knowledge I learned from the mental health consultant during this case and applied it to other patients. This program will allow patients to receive efficient mental health care and build the skills the providers need to continue this work. It is a benefit to trainees, the future physicians of Minnesota, our patients, and our future patients. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Dr. Xiong. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Xiong. I work at Change Inc. as the clinical director. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist and a Minnesota board-approved clinical supervisor for practitioners on the marriage and family therapy and professional counseling track. The last 10 years, I've invested a significant part of my professional life to BIPOC mental health workforce development. I have personal experience of challenges that impacted me becoming a mental health provider myself. I experienced loneliness and discouragement. No one in my graduate program looked like me. The cost to becoming a licensed mental health professional was monumental. Also, it was hard to find a BIPOC supervisor. I wanted to connect with someone who had cultural context for my experience. 15 years ago, I became a recipient of a DHS grant called Cultural Ethnic Minority Infrastructure Grant. I'm going to call it CMIG for short. And without it, I would not be where I am right now. This grant helped to expedite my licensure process and helped me to find my purpose, which is to contribute towards BIPOC workforce development. Now I am paying it forward, providing clinical supervision to BIPOC practitioners and providing trainings to become a clinical supervisor. We use CMIG funds to develop paid internships for practitioners, and in the last 6 months, a total of 5 BIPOC practitioners became licensed mental health professionals and remains in the field. They are the first to get their higher education and the main providers of their families. And without CMIG, they would have to pick between child care and supervision or groceries and training. Since the killing of George Floyd, anti-Asian hate, and the rescinding of the DACA and DAPA program, ICE raids and roundup of migrant families, members from cultural and ethnic minority communities are increasingly seeking help from providers who are from their community. According to a 2021 report on funding diversity in Minnesota, it demonstrates the lack of BIPOC providers available. For example, it showed that there was one Hispanic provider per 1,680 Hispanics. At our outpatient clinic, a Latina woman waited 2 months for a provider from her culture. In the field, this is considered a short wait. People feel discouraged to enter and stay in the field. And with the lack of BIPOC providers, members from cultural and ethnic communities are not seeking mental health care. We need to support and provide resources during practitioners' licensure process and professional career to encourage people to make mental health care their career and not a stepping stone. It should be their destination. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I don't see anyone else in the public who wants to testify on the bill. Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for the second testifier, Dr. Shaina. Okay. And while you're getting ready. You had mentioned that you had had in the training to be able to determine which medicine and dosage and et cetera. Did the training include PGX?
Can you clarify what PGX is?
Pharmacogenomics. At the U of M, Dr. Pamela Jacobson is the professor and director of the Institute for Personalized Medicine. And one of the biggest issues with healthcare disparities is because a lot of the medicines out there are maybe work great for 60% or 80% of the population, but with the appropriate genomic information, and it's very common in mental health to have these tests so you get the right medicine and you have a pretty good idea of what the first dosage is instead of waiting a year and a half to find out.
Yeah, so I did get training in that as a medical school student, not specifically during my residency training. Right now, the standard of practice to get kids started on medicine is to try some of our first-line treatments that have been approved in kids. There's really only one medication that has been FDA approved for that. And then if that is not working, we look to our psychiatry colleagues to be the ones to administer that test, interpret the results, and make sure that we can get kids on the appropriate medications.
Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that if we're looking at improving the education, we need to be more mainstreaming PGX and the individualized medicine, because there are so many groups that have disproportionate outcomes, and I think that comes with from the fact that we go to our standard, you know, first in line stuff instead of looking at the cutting edge science that tells us, well, we should be trying, you're using this medication to be more effective. And that way you can, the first medicine is more effective instead of waiting for the second or third.
Thank you. And right now during residency, we're taught what the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends. And so those are the guidelines that in which we follow.
With your quick closing remarks, Chair Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good bill and I appreciate the committee's support.
Indeed, it's a good bill. All those in favor, I renew my motion that House File 1436 be re-referred to Health, Policy, and Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails, and you're on your way to Health. The next bill is House File 1172. Representative Edelson, welcome to the committee.
The other one right there.
I'll move House File 1172 to be laid over for possible inclusion. I see you have A1 amendment, and I also wanted to move A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, if you guys wouldn't mind adopting that, it was unfortunately I had had that specific statute included when it was not supposed to be in the section for the 5-year.
So this puts the bill in the shape the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the A1 amendment is adopted. You to your bill as amended.
Committee and members, so House Bill 1172 is the result of a task force and a bill that Senator Abler and I worked on many years ago. And I want to thank the task force. We have a few of them here today. They worked tirelessly over a year to really look at the DHS background checks to see what we could do. And I just want to highlight a few things. I have a bunch of written statements, but I think we're going to gloss over those so that we can make sure that we can get to our testifiers. Currently, how the DHS background checks work are they're based on 4 levels. There's misdemeanors that are at 7 years for lookbacks, gross misdemeanors that are 10 years for the lookback, felony level is 15, and then we have permanent disqualifications. So with that, when the task force was doing their work, what we really put into the 5-year category, I guess first, are drug possession, misdemeanor theft and receipt of stolen property, and issuance of dishonor checks. We're moving a lot of those down from 7-year to 5-year. And theft, when the task force was looking at which ones were disqualifications, theft was the top misdemeanor, and it accounted for about 50% of the disqualifications. To make the picture clear on some of these issues, misdemeanor theft is $500 or less. Gross misdemeanor theft is $500 to about just under $1,000. Felony theft is $1,000 or more. I want to highlight that fifth-degree drug possession and felony-level controlled substance receive a 90% set aside when they apply for reconsideration. In 2018, DHS background checks, there was about 7,622 that were disqualified. One-third of them were or requests for reconsideration, and about 75% of those requests were approved. In 2019, of the DHS background checks that happened, 12,928 were disqualified. Again, one-third of those were reconsidered or at request for reconsideration, and about 65% were approved. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will go to my testifiers, but I just want to speak to there are very serious disparities here in terms of socioeconomics, as also racial disparities that happen within this bill. And that's predominantly what I think I will let our testifiers speak to more. So thank you.
Professor, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Roy Kammer. I'm a faculty member at Minnesota State University, Mankato. I teach in our alcohol and drug studies program. I train alcohol and drug counselors. I am licensed as an alcohol and drug counselor and a professional counselor. I got to serve on this task force that's been mentioned. I chaired our data analysis subcommittee. We were fortunate to take a look at a lot of data that just hadn't been looked at in this way before. We got to collaborate with our colleagues at DHS, and I must say that there was a lot of data. And you know, just some of the key points, just to emphasize what's been said here already, in 2018, over 184,000 background studies. In 2019, over 210,000. Now, while a lot of those lead to eligibility, there are those that are disqualified, and that's where we spent a lot of our time looking. Regarding disparities, when we take a look at eligible determinations versus disqualified determinations, one would hope that the racial ethnic breakdown would look relatively similar between those two. But what we found was that in our eligible determinations, we saw a greater representation of white individuals. When we took a look at our disqualifications, greater representation showing up for people of color. We followed this all the way throughout the process. We saw disparities when we took a look at level of severity determinations. When we looked at who was actually applying for reconsideration, disparity all the way throughout. The other place where we spent a lot of time looking was what happened to those people, those individuals who were disqualified. And as you heard already, many times when those people seek reconsideration, they are determined eligible to work. So what we did is we took a look at 2018, 2019 to come up with our top 10 list to see the most common crime and conduct, to see if it was consistent year over year. And generally speaking, yes, it was. Then we took a look at those top crimes and conduct to see how many people were applying for reconsideration, and of those, how often were these individuals being determined eligible to work? In many cases, 70, 80, 90 plus percent of the time, they were being determined eligible to work. So in fields where we have people dying, where we have workforce shortages, and we put a lot of time and resource into determining they are eligible to work, is there a way we can do this better to help this process along? With that, I am going to defer to our next testifier.
Mr. Fowler, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jeff Powell, better known in the community as JP. I'm an alcohol and drug counselor and wellness instructor for Twin Cities Wellness Center Recovery Gym. I'm the executive director and founder of the Minnesota Hope Dealers Recovery Community Organization, a recovery advocate and also a person in long-term recovery. And what that means to me is becoming the change that I want to see. I came here to address some discrepancies that we have with the DHS set-aside and background studies processes. I myself has been convicted for felonies and had been denied reconsideration from the DHS. I seeked help out for my addiction, and I also take full accountability for my actions, including dealing with my mental illnesses due to the environment that I was raised in, homelessness and low self-esteem. I worked hard on myself, not only to become a better version of myself, but to become a productive citizen in society, and to push all my efforts into helping out the community. I went to college and to become a drug and alcohol counselor. I became president of the Honor Society and a part of the Collegiate Recovery Program. The last year that I was in college, which was 2020, I was faced with a disqualification. Not just one, but three. It stated that I was eligible to work in the field of study for 15 years with the final decision. And the only from final decision without any type of form of probationary period. And the only way that I could overturn that was to go through the appellate court, which was stated. So I went through the appellate court, and that process took over a year for even a course to look at. So I wasn't able to graduate with my graduating class. And the reason, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to become a drug counselor is because during the tenure that I had in treatment myself, I rarely seen a counselor that looked like me or came from the same background as me, which I feel that's important. I feel it's important in the name of relativity to basically have role models to help guide people out of dark places that we had the ability to overcome. And to be transparent, I feel there's not many African-American males in our field due to the discrepancies of the background study and set-aside protocols. So I believe that change and reform could alleviate some of these disparities. Thank you.
Thank you so much, JP, and thank you so much for all the work that you do in the community. The next person I have is Mr. Page, Senior Assistant Hennepin County Attorney. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and members of the committee. My name is Max Page. I am a senior attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I also had the privilege of serving for the last year on the task force. Throughout that year, we heard from many people who had committed crimes, usually crimes related to substance abuse or crimes of poverty, low-level theft crimes. And due to some of our most stringent laws in the nation, Minnesota disqualifies those people from serving in positions that require a DHS background study and licensure. Sometimes these disqualification periods are up to 15 years, and that's just a really long time to prevent people from working in certain fields. A lot of people turn their lives around within a 15-year period. A lot of people turn their lives around within a one-year period, and a person is quite different in many cases from the time they're 25 to the time they're 40, for example. County attorneys want to hold people accountable for the crimes that they commit. But we also agree that criminal convictions should not prevent people from holding meaningful employment for a long period of time. We know that one of the best crime prevention methods is meaningful, stable employment. And by preventing people from achieving that, we are encouraging them essentially to continue to work in a world where laws don't apply. We also know that some of the people who have gone through trials and tribulations through chemical substance abuse or criminal activity and turned their lives around become some of the best advocates for people who they're serving, for the people that they're serving. This bill that Representative Edelson has authored takes some really good first steps in adopting the recommendations of the task force. I personally think it does not go far enough. I think the bill could be simplified. It creates an additional tier, which is good, but if you read the task force report, which I highly recommend, it recommends a simpler 5-year and permanent disqualification period, which is reflective of the foster care licensing reform that was recently passed. that deals with these same issues. There are also safeguards for employers and for the public that is included in the legislation, and I can talk about that if anyone has questions about them. Just to finish up, I do want to thank Representative Edelson for taking the work of the committee, the task force, and putting it into a bill effort, and folks from DHS were very helpful too. Also, Representatives Fisher and I believe Zeleznikar is going to join on as co-author, and so I thank you for your support as well. I do just want to finally note that I was appointed to the task force to represent the viewpoint of a county attorney, but not specifically for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I'm not representing their view here today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Member discussions, Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you to Representative Edelson for bringing this bill. This is something that's been near and dear to my heart for a long time. As a nursing home administrator, I've seen the devastation to the healthcare industry. So to JP, thank you for everything you've done. I've been fighting for change for a long time and filling out applications for applicants to try to get disqualifications removed, working with probation offices and going around the tree the wrong way for a decade, if not more. And so, you know, I think that there's a place for penalty, but then there's a place to invest people back into the workforce. And so it is, to me, disheartening to think that this is what we've had to deal with for so long. Employers have been trying to help employees transition back. And so, you know, I'm thrilled to see we're having some mental health, some chemical dependency, some addiction, all these types of things happening in a different format, and then deal with the violent criminals that we all agree on, what that looks like, and then transition the rest of society back in a meaningful way. Sometimes it's probation, but I just am thrilled to see, because 15 years is a long time, and I have had people in my office for years crying. Bounce check, and I could name off the list that disqualified them from every ethnic background, female, male, every aged person. And the money and time it takes to try to figure out how to go through the court system to get their records expunged or get this taken care of. And all along, they're ineligible to work. And we can't have them in healthcare settings until this is done or we get a citation. And so it prohibits a lot of great people from being wonderful caregivers or child care providers and a multiple of other businesses. So I just want to say thank you. I think this is going to be a bipartisan thing that will serve the state of Minnesota in a great way. And I'm thrilled. So thank you very much.
With that, Representative Edelson, your closing remarks.
Well, thank you, Representative Zeleznikar. I said your name right this time. Last time I was here, I really do appreciate that. I think this is a bipartisan effort. As I said in the last committee, no person is all good and no person is all bad. People need second chances. And what we have right now is when we need care, working in a nursing home, no, we need in our PCAs, our care facilities, we have so many open jobs right now. We really do need to give people second chances. And this is a great way to do that. So again, a first step. And so thank you for your support.
Thank you so much, Representative Edelson, for bringing this bill forward. This is an important discussion. We'll continue to have the discussion throughout this session, and also hopefully by the end of next session we will have resolved all the issues. Hopefully. Thank you so much. I renew my motion that House File 1172 be laid over for possible inclusion as amended. The bill is laid over. The next bill is Representative Baker's bill, House File 2544. Please go ahead and move the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 2544. For possible consideration for laying it over the bill here in this committee. Members,
I see an A1 amendment.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I wanted to get the A1 amendment in here, too. If I could, this is a kind of a technical, but it's also just updates all the information so it lines up with our colleagues on the other body. And if you could, I'd like to move the A1 amendment to match up to the bill.
Representative Vecchia moves A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape of the ordinance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what this is it's getting our rates lined up to where it has to be and should be with medically assisted treatment. That is really important medicine to keep people in sobriety and recovery much longer. And it's a complicated system, but we need to make sure that we get this thing moving along forward. House File 2544, as amended now, changes those rate settings methodology and the rates for opioid treatment programs. As you know, we have an opioid crisis here in Minnesota. Non-fatal opioid-involved overdoses increased more than 147% in the last 5 years. Opioid-involved overdose deaths increased by more than 1,100%. Since 2000 and in between the last 20 years. So I'm offering 2544 as an alternative to DHS's proposed new rate system for opioid treatment program providers. The federal government on both sides of the aisle has supported efforts to combat the opioid epidemic by increasing rates and introducing new bundled rate systems to expand needed treatments and better meet the needs of those impacted by the opioid use. This bill will take advantage of the work done by our federal government by replacing Minnesota's current rate system with one that mirrors the Medicare bundled rate system. The Medicare rates, the future rates adjustment applied to the Medicare opioid treatment program services. The benefit of matching this up, members, is that it will reduce administrative burden for DHS. Let me say that again. It's going to help DHS with less work, and they are looking for those options as well, and it gives the and it also gives providers, because the Medicare system already exists and will raise the rates to stabilize the existing services and encourage an expansion of these new services. So I appreciate your support for this bill. It's an important recalculation of these services, and at this time I'll turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Brian Seward, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Sawada. I'm the Minnesota Regional Director for Behavioral Health Group. Behavioral Health Group is an outpatient opioid treatment program provider in Minnesota with locations in Brainerd, Minneapolis, Woodbury, and Brooklyn Park. At Behavioral Health Group, we know that opioid addiction is not a moral failing. It's a chronic disease of the brain that requires evidence-based treatment and management. We also know that real recovery is possible even as patients continue their daily lives, living at home, holding down a job, and engaging with their families and communities. I'm here today to express my support for House File 2544. Representative Baker mentioned the crisis we are facing in our nation and in Minnesota because of opioid use. We are on the front line in addressing this epidemic, and I believe House File 2544 will help. The bill will bring structural alignment on how services are billed under the Minnesota Medical Assistance Opioid Treatment Program and Medicare. This will reduce administrative costs and confusion as one billing structure works better than two separate systems. Matching the Medicare system will also free up state resources and agency staff time, as they will not need to develop and implement their own unique system, but can piggyback on the research and work done at the federal level concerning OTP treatment best practices. One other benefit of using similar systems is that it allows for an apples-to-apples comparison of the Minnesota program with that of the federal government and other states that have adopted the Medicare approach. This type of comparison does not work with either the current system or the system proposed by DHS. Federal law requires that a state's Medicaid payments be sufficient to enlist enough providers so that care and services are available under the plan. I don't feel the current payments meet this requirement. How Minnesota's reimbursement rates for OTP services compared to other states is not always clear, as states vary on how they pay for OTP services. But one thing is evident. Minnesota's reimbursements are low compared to other states, and alarmingly low when compared to Medicare. This bill will increase Minnesota rates to the Medicare level and assist in increasing access to needed OTP services in Minnesota. Finally, House File 2544 provides for future rate adjustments aligned with Medicare rate changes to make certain that the program and access to OTP services are available now and into the future. Please support House File 2544. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions? Mr. Beck, I think you've got a good bill that no one wants.
I do. You know, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair and members, and I do hope you support the bill. I hope it does. It's really an important bill to make our final landing strip here to the omnibus bill as we move forward. Medically assisted treatments are super important for the recovery of so many people. And this covers a number of those options, not just one or two of them, but it covers a lot of them. We've got injectables. We've got long-term stuff. And this is important, and I like how it's actually set up with the Medicare program. It moves when Medicare moves. It doesn't move when otherwise. If drug prices drop, it's going to drop. So if we get this on a larger scale, I think long-term it's going to be the better move for Minnesota. It'll be easier for DHS to manage. Members, I just hope you support the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker, for your continuous advocacy and also championing the issues that surround substance use disorder.
Thank you.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 2544, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. The final bill, members, we have is House File 1845. Representative Wiener, welcome to the committee. While you come down, please. I will move House File 1845 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Before you, there is a supply of apples. As is customary, freshman legislators bring in a treat. And I thought, what better to have a healthy treat?
Representative Winters, you're the only one who has won the prize for this committee. So we were wondering who brought the apples. So.
Anything I can do to butter up the committee to make sure this bill goes through, we're good.
I think everybody should take a note, you know, for those who didn't do this.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm pleased and honored to present House File 1845 today. I'd like to note that 1845 is supported by both Republicans and Democrats. We're all aware of the mental health substance use crisis in Minnesota. Unfortunately, it's increasing. We do not have disregard to work other mental health organizations are doing. In fact, we applaud them. The concerns are that rural Minnesota has even less support than the metro area, along with the transportation issues. The fact remains that rural Minnesota lacks access to care. When crisis rises, they have nowhere to go, and this is one of the reasons the number of hospitalizations are going up. I ask of you, why not decrease that? Peer support does that. They support individuals who may not have a diagnosis and use peer support rather than intensive, costly services. This is why I want to talk to you about Wellness in the Woods. Minnesota is lucky to have such an organization, as I'm learning they're the only one in Minnesota that provides this type of service. I firmly believe that Wellness in the Woods will bridge the gap in rural areas and underserved communities, as well as provide employment to 50 individuals in recovery. As their mission states, they are dedicated to improving access to mental health care and substance use recovery for all residents of Minnesota, with a focus on reaching underserved communities. The key here is access, and to all Minnesotans, not just greater Minnesota, regardless of where they are in the state. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Victor Obisakin, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Victor Obisakin, and I'm the Director of Peer Programs and Legislative Liaison for Wellness in the Woods. Our mission is simple. Our mission is to provide accessible, affordable, and helpful peer-led resources with compassionate and non-judgmental support and advocacy and opportunities for those who are experiencing or have been affected by mental health and substance use challenges to be heard. We want to focus on reaching the underserved communities. It breaks my heart to hear that people who are having mental health challenges are being handcuffed and put in the back of squad cars. I believe with the right tools and education, we can make a difference. We have the tools and programs at our organization to make that difference. Here are some warm line numbers our warm line director gave me. In the last year, we have had over 25,000 calls from 68 counties and two reservations in Minnesota. From those calls, 5,389 calls were from six of our identified diverse communities: African, African American, Asian, Asian American, Native American, Hispanic, Latinx, and LGBTQ+, and rural. These are the six DHS wanted us to make sure we report on. 988 and 211 refer people to our warm line. We believe we could reach out to even more Minnesotans. We just need help with a little funding. I want to use this time to thank Chair Noor, members of the committee, Representative Wiener, and some of you that shared the same passion as us, and to all my hardworking peers out there who are listening today. Also, to all the LAs, CAs, I respectfully disturbed numerous of times, Sebastian, Sean, and Luke, thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about House File 1845. My name is Monica Yaden. I'm employed by Wellness in the Woods as the Operations and Communications Coordinator. One of my many duties is to provide our Virtual Peer Support Network, or VPSN, with direction and support. The VPSN is, for all intents and purposes, a Zoom room that is open for 6 hours a day, and for four of those hours, we offer simple peer support. People can hop on and just chat with us about whatever they have going on or if they're just feeling lonely. For 2 hours a day, we also offer programming. And you can look on our calendar. We do lots of different programming, anything from art to DBT skills. I have submitted a PowerPoint which expands on some of the numbers in the written testimony, but I do want to highlight some of those now. Numbers can tell you a lot about a program, how it is run, and how effective it is. In 2022, we had approximately 3,537 interactions on VPSN, averaging about 10 interactions per day from across the state. After 2.5 months of 2023, VPSN has already supported 1,002 interactions, averaging 13 participants per day. For each attendance record, our staff started indicating whether the participant joined for chatting, programming, or both in August 2022. From August to December, 36.2% of attendees joined just to chat with us, 19.5% of attendees joined just for the programming portion, and 44.3% of attendees joined for both discussion and programming. These numbers tell us that we are offering programming that is meaningful to our participants and that our staff can help each participant feel welcome in our discussions. I can't speak for anybody but myself, and I do know that when I access a service that does not meet my expectations, I do not go back to it. For this reason, I find the percentage of returning participants particularly telling. In 2022, approximately 92% of our interactions were with returning attendees. In addition to indicating that we need to be able to fund more outreach efforts to increase our number of new attendees, it also tells us that our participants find value in the service and continue to come back to it over and over again. This grant appropriation would help us continue to provide effective peer support services to all Minnesota residents. There were 42 counties in Minnesota that had no presence on VPSN through the entire year of 2022. These dollars would give us the freedom to reach county residents who have yet to hear about and or benefit from our services. I am, in addition to being a peer support specialist myself, I am also a licensed macro social worker, and I have a very deep passion, I have a very deep passion for data and numbers. I hope that the numbers I have given you today have painted a picture of an effective and much needed service. I would also like to highlight the two testimonial statements, included in the PowerPoint from real VPSN participants that tell the anecdotal stories of what VPSN has given them. These testimonials with the numbers, I believe, tell the full story about this program. Thank you very much for this opportunity to present you to you in support of House File 1845.
Thank you, Ms. Hayden, for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public? We have George. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Jody Freiholtz-London. I'm the executive director and founder of Wellness in the Woods. I usually identify myself as the vanilla farm girl from Todd County. I had no plans ever to lead an organization 10 years ago, but I had worked for 7 nonprofits that failed because they lost their mission, because they lost their point in moving forward. So I knew how not to manage. My background is in vocational rehabilitation, but I went through my own mental health challenge during one of those termination periods from one of those organizations. And I knew that Minnesota, especially greater Minnesota, but all of Minnesota, needed to have a voice for a system to change and to be able to serve every single one of us. I am now blessed to say that we are celebrating our 10th anniversary, and I work with 50 people, all who are certified as peer specialists and serve both diverse and geographic cultures. We have three main programs. One of them is the Virtual Peer Support Network that Monica talked about. Victor oversees our SAMHSA grant, our federal grant, which all of these grants and all of these dollars require us to keep explicit data and report. It also gives us the opportunity to see where the gaps are. Thus, we have just submitted a huge grant to SAMHSA again around reentry, using some of our staff to help people who are leaving incarceration. We have a number of our staff who are working and have been incarcerated. Every single one of our team members are people who identify as having a lived experience with mental health, incarceration, or substance use challenges. Our goal is to break down those silos between substance use and mental health and to support people for who they are and where they are. Thus, we do not have eligibility requirements. We do not use billing system. Anybody can come to us support. We have callers on our warm line who call because they burnt their brownies or their dog is sick, and that's okay. We want them to know we are there for them, that we have been through some of these struggles and challenges. One example of one of our long-term staff is Bert. If you know Bert, he's covered with tattoos, and he kind of looks like an outlaw and identifies as one. Bert's been in every prison from San Quentin to Stillwater, and now Bert has worked with us and has security clearance to go and work in Oak Park Heights to support other individuals who are leaving incarceration. He's working with some of our small county jails and giving hope on purpose, which is what he calls his program. I will tell you that the individuals that I have been blessed to work with are making a difference. We are saving lives, and with this funding, we will promise you to ethically expand that hope on purpose.
Thank you, Ms. Freiholtz, London, for your testimony. Don't see anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill. Member discussion, Chair Fry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say hi to all. We met on Zoom. Now we're here in person. And with all of the other great testifiers or participants that was on the Zoom meeting that I was able to attend for a while. So glad that you made it this far. Thank you, Representative Weiner, for bringing this bill forward. Very exciting to hear and see people. And one of the conversations that we had on Zoom was kind of about the barrier to employment because of background checks and because of these multiple layers of mental illness and substance abuse and then incarceration. And I guess I'm kind of hopeful that maybe these things are going to be working together and that we can loosen up the the eligibility for new job categories with people that have something very particular and very powerful to share with their peers going forward. So it seems to be a great concept, and that this is a great set of meetings today. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and staff.
Thank you. Representative Kwok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair and members. Frankly, the shortage of personnel is a common issue across MDH. We've heard several bills with peer-to-peer support and as a component. I think as we work on these bills and look at the areas, we should really look at how we can include and leverage peer-to-peer and peer support to augment and help cover some of the shortages we have. Because oftentimes the peer-to-peer has the component of someone that understands, maybe has experienced, and you connect with people. And that credibility and connection, I think, is very important. So I like the author's bill, and I wish we cross-pollinated across more areas. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Kwan. With that, I have Representative Baker.
Thank you, and thank you, Jody, for being here today. This is a really good work that you do, and I met you a few years ago back in Wilmer at one of the conferences we had, and your work is remarkable. The testimony today was great. And I'm just maybe challenging you to something in the future that we needed to work on, especially in greater Minnesota that we sometimes forget about. But our diverse community in greater Minnesota needs some specialty care as well. Again, we've got a lot of Somali community in greater Minnesota that we don't know how to reach out to them yet in this world of mental health and recovery. It's different. Same with our Latino population. And, you know, working with some members here about more of the urban stuff and how we're still struggling with this. But is there any thoughts for Wellness in the Woods to expand a little bit and maybe have some virtual network meetings, discussions about how we can connect better with those community members that are also struggling, but they really don't have a way to reach us? And I think sometimes we forget about that. Is there any thoughts on
your That's story? A great question. That's a great question, because coming from this vanilla girl from Todd County, that was pretty much all that I knew. Thankfully, Victor came into my life, mm-hmm. as well as a number of other diverse staff from diverse communities, including New Americans, which we are waiting with bated breath right now, because we have submitted a grant to create a cultural training within our organization and in a community, of which if we get that, we're going to pop Victor right into that. I didn't know if you knew that for sure, Victor, but he has just been an amazing asset. We also have working relationships with the Sober Squad, which is predominantly Native American, and work with the Afro-American Development Association, which is New Americans in Moorhead. So that is absolutely first and forefront, and was at the top of our strategic plan this year in December.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Bay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Representative, for your closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Chair and members, and I don't have any other closing remarks at this time other than enjoy the apples.
Members, don't forget to do that. House file, I renew my motion that House file 1845 be laid over for possible inclusion. House file 1845 is laid over. Members, on Monday and Wednesday, thanks to Chair Fisher, we don't have the policy committee hearing. We're going to be picking up all the other bills that we have to do the hearing. So Monday and Tuesday at 1 p.m. in this room, we'll continue with Human Services Finance. So I just wanted to let you know. So Tuesday and Thursday is our regular schedule, but we are adding Monday and Wednesday to be included. So we have 4 days of human services. Just be ready.
All better changes. Okay.
We will be picking up non-controversial bills on Monday and Wednesday so that people are aware of that. These are bills that we have to process before the end of 1 p.m. in this room. So
bills for Monday are not
I just wanted to thank you all, and with no further agenda items before us, we are now adjourned. So. Yeah.